This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting,
lightsaber clashing,
the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping,
banshee flying,
space mountain launching,
galaxy rewinding,
what's the whole necklace galaxy rewinding,
fireworks igniting,
world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
You're listening to The Western Rookie, a hunting podcast full of tips, tricks, and strategies from seasoned Western hunters. There are plenty of opportunities out there. We just need to learn how to take on the challenges.
Hunting is completely different up there.
I've harvested 26 big game animals.
You can fool their eyes, but you can't fool their nose.
300 yards back to the road turned into 3 miles back the other way.
It's always cool seeing new hunters go and harvest an animal.
I don't know what to expect.
If there's anybody I want in the woods with me, it'll be you.
Welcome back to another Western Rookie Podcast brought to you by Go Hunt. I'm your host, Brian Krebs. And before we kick this episode off, I'm just going to ask you, take a quick minute and give the podcast a rating or a review on whichever platform you're listening on. It really helps us grow the show, and I greatly appreciate it. That way we can help more people learn how to hunt the West and feel that passion and excitement when they're 40 yards from a bugle and bull elk or whatever animal they are chasing. I promise you we'll still be here when you get back. But if you want to go do that, I really do appreciate it. And with that, let's kick this episode off. We have Tyler Presler on the call today. How are you doing today, Tyler?
I'm doing good, man. No complaints here. So hunting season's right around the corner. We're about, 10 days or so away here in Nebraska. So we're getting close.
You're in Nebraska.
I am. Yeah.
Which part of Nebraska? Like which direction?
Northeast corner.
Northeast corner. Okay, so you're kind of down by, is that the Yankton River?
Yeah. We're about an hour a little northwest of Omaha and an hour north of Lincoln. So to kind of give you a little geographic region.
Well, ironically, 10 days from now, I'll be going to Nebraska with my bow.
There we go.
That's why I asked. Do you get this time of the year, I would say, maybe the last 2 weeks up until season, do you get this sense of like impending urgency and like, I'm not ready. Like time is moving too fast. I haven't been doing enough. I got all these things I got to get done. Do you get that sense or is that just me?
No, I'm right there with you, especially this year. So it's, you know, I got a little one now, so time's a little harder to kind of scratch out some of those moments to prepare, but we're getting there. So
yeah, and that's the problem. It comes either way, whether you're ready or not. It's like, here I come. It's like good old game of hide and seek, and fall just sneaks right up on you. When I was single, living, you know, in a city, I was living in a city. I had like a town home. There's nothing to do ever, right? I was shooting my bow all the time. I was doing 10 reps in the morning in my basement before work. I was shooting in the evenings in the backyard. There's never anything to do. Now we live on a farm, like a 40-acre farmstead with hunting land. And it's like, man, there's always something to do, right? I was going to shoot my bow last night in practice. And we just started doing saddles this year. It's our first year in saddles. And we got the XOP set up. That's who we're going to Nebraska with. I'm really excited for this hunt. And I was going to shoot, I'm going to dedicate like 2 hours. I'm going to be shooting my bow, getting up and down in that saddle, just practicing. I've been doing a little bit of it. Well, sure enough, I get a guy on Facebook that wants to come buy a bunch of oak logs from me. And then my fertilizer shows up, my liquid fertilizer shows up for our food plots, and it's about to rain. So I'm like, hey, I should spray this and I should do that. And all of a sudden it's like dark out. And I'm like, well, another night I didn't get any shooting in.
Yep.
So it
sounds like, are you whitetail hunting opener?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I mean, if a mule deer walks underneath me, I won't hesitate as well. I think we'll be – I should ask you this. So we have the statewide archery tags. From what I read, we can shoot mule deer bucks as non-residents as long as we are not in one of the mule deer conservation areas.
I believe that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if the game warden asked me, I'd be like, Tyler told me I could do this.
I'm pretty certain that's correct. I know they did a lot of changing this year with the regulations. So
yeah,
I'd maybe do a quick double check. But yeah, I'm pretty certain as long as it's a statewide archery and you're not in that mule deer conservation area, you're good to go for a buck.
Yeah.
Does, I'm pretty sure, are still off limits, but
for non-residents, I do think that the mule deer does. And quite frankly, I'm not a guy that I think will ever shoot a mule deer doe, or at least not for a long time. Just with mule deer populations going the direction they've been going, I think they need all the help they can get, and I'm not going to go out there and whack any mamas.
That's fair.
Yeah. I don't think we will see a lot of mule deer because we're going to be – apparently we're testing out some new product and we got a photographer coming along. So I think we're really going to kind of stick to the saddles and I just don't know if we're going to be in the right areas to really have high chances at mule deer. I'm guessing they're probably higher up in the broken country. You know, not necessarily always in the river bottoms next to like oak flats and oak, you know, mounds, but you never know.
You don't, you know, we don't have anywhere we are here. You know, we're all whitetail here, but
yeah,
I mean, I could drive an hour and a half a little bit west of here and some guys start running into them. So
we will be west, far enough west that we will probably see some driving around and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never shot a mule deer with my bow, so that would be cool.
There we go.
That would be cool. But no, I wanted to get you on the podcast because it seems like you've gone on quite a few adventures. Some hunts, a lot of people say a once in a lifetime hunt, and I think it gets overused because from what I've found, a lot of times when you do these once in a lifetime hunts, you come home and be like, okay, how do I do it again? Right? How do I do this next year? A lot of people will say, I'm going to go on my once in a lifetime elk hunt, and then they elk hunt every year after that. So,
yep, it's so true.
Yeah, it gets overused. But in your case, I think you've probably have done a few once in a lifetime, true once in a lifetime hunts. And I think that'd be really cool to hear your story on this.
Definitely one of them for sure. My sheep hunt last year was probably a once in a lifetime hunt unless I get lucky in a draw. So,
yeah. So yeah, let's kick off with the sheep hunt. That's the big one. You know, I think a lot of people know that sheep hunting is something different, right? It's not common. You don't probably know. Maybe a lot of people probably don't even know a sheep hunter. They've never met someone that shot a sheep. And so they're like, I don't know. It seems like it's probably like harder maybe. And you know, not a lot of people do it. Maybe it's hard to get tags, whatnot. I don't know if a lot of people really understand how extreme every aspect of sheep hunting is. Like, you know, when we do our draw odds, in the lower 48 with the Go Hunt bonus series. You know, I'll touch on the sheep, but I usually gloss over it because I'm like, hey, if you want to draw a sheep in Nevada, you're looking at 0.001%. And you're like, so it means it's going to take you 10,000 years on average to draw this tag, right?
And that's assuming things don't change.
Yeah.
More people are going to apply. Odds are going to get worse.
Sheep populations are, you know, just like sheep are hard critters to keep alive. I mean, you talk to any farmer and that, you know, sheep get diseases. They die. Yeah. They're not durable. Like elk are durable. They are very hard to kill. You know, they're disease resistant. They're hardy. They like cold winters. You know, they can handle high heat summers. You know, sheep are not that. You know, they get one whiff of pneumonia and the whole herd is gone. Yeah. So, yeah, it's hard to draw, very hard to draw a tag. And that's just the beginning. I mean, that truly is probably the easy part, is getting the tag.
Depending on the hunt, let's just say that.
Yeah.
Depending on the hunt. Some are obviously easier than others. And, you know, if I ever get lucky enough to draw a Nebraska sheep tag, they draw one a year. I mean.
Yeah, Bighorns in the Black Hills. Maybe different than where you went to go get your doll sheep. So the question was that an Alaska hunt or were you in the Canada?
So I was up in Canada. Up in Northwest Territories.
Okay. Okay.
Yep.
So I'm guessing then you had to go with an outfitter just with Canada's big game rules.
Yep. Had to go with an outfitter up there. So
that's incredible. So you found a way, which I guess maybe there's a part of the work of sheep hunting is like you got to work your tail off for a few years to do that too. I mean, there's no good way to go sheep hunting. You can wait 40 years and try to draw a tag. You can do a DIY tag in Alaska and a few places over the counter in Montana, but then you're looking at like there might be two sheep in my entire 100 square miles and I got to figure out where they are and then get to them. Not easy. Or you got to work your tail off and find an outfitter that's got an opening and, you know, be picking up extra overtime shifts and all kinds of stuff because it's not cheap because of the demand. And so there's no matter how you slice it, there's not a way to be like, hey, it's August 21 while we're having this conversation. I want to go sheep hunting this year. It's like, good luck. Go to a farm and pick out your nanny and bring it home. I don't know. So it's a tough one. So
it is.
You got the, you know, the pre-work done, right? You did the overtime or whatever you got on the list. What's it like going into a sheep hunt with the preparation? Like, what were you doing to make sure you were getting every ounce of experience out of that trip as possible, knowing that it likely is one of the only times you'll ever do it?
So much goes into a sheep hunt, you know? So the hunt was 2023. I'm trying to think when I booked it. I want to say, I think I put my deposit down in 2020 or 2021 for my 2023 hunt.
Oh, wow.
So
ways out.
So just there alone, the anticipation plus COVID happened. Canada completely shut their borders. So they had, was it one full season of no sheep hunters at all? So there was a lot of struggle when it came to redoing the schedules, certain guys getting bumped. They asked for volunteers to say, hey, do you want to hunt your same year? Do you want to push it? You know, it's going to cost the same. Do what you need to do. We understand, but we got to try to get guys in. So it was stressful, you know, leading up to it. But finally, after all that kind of panned out, as far as the preparation leading up to it that summer, I mean, that was actually right about a year ago. I was up there August of last year. And like you said, fitness is a big thing. This was a bit of a gentleman's sheep hunt. So the Northwest Territories can do helicopter assist. So that's how they access country is via helicopter. So it's just the route that I ended up going. Honestly, it was availability. You know, I wanted to go to Northwest Territories because I knew I could get in.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of the way most of their outfits are up there. There's one in the entire outfit up in Northwest Territory that does not do helicopter. But the outfit I went with does, but it's still a hard hunt. You know, they get you close. They get you close enough and you kind of have to go from there. So
the helicopter assist, they're bringing you to like the valley, right?
Essentially. Yep.
Yep. Like these high, I don't know what the best correlation would be, but it's, you know, it's a high elevation valley, right? And then, you know, the sheep, you know, they can't land you on the shale up on the mountain where the sheep actually are, right? So you still have to climb.
You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised.
Well, do they hover and let you just jump out? But
not quite. I mean, obviously, so it's Northwest Territories. It's nice rolling hills, and it's not okay. Certain areas are super steep and super shaley, but it's not kind of what you expect, like what you see in like Alaska, you know.
Okay.
So a lot of them are nice rounded tops, you know, so they can drop you on those fairly well. But still, you got to hike. You got to find the sheep. You got to hike, and just because they're not in that basin, I mean, they could still be three basins over. So you still got to go find them.
Yeah, and there's still no hunting the day you fly anywhere. So even if you see sheep on the way in, you can't go get them. You can't land too close or they're not going to be there. You know, there's still a lot of things that go into it. So you were just, you know, full on fitness, I assume, probably doing a lot of endurance work, a lot of lung capacity work.
Yep. A lot of bike, a lot of running, a lot of Stairmaster.
Yeah. Because if you're doing the helicopter assist, which, hey, there's a lot of ways you can be a badass, and you don't have to, you know, walk from your house in Nebraska up to the Northwest Territories to be a badass. And, you know, I use tractors to plant my food plots instead of doing them by hand too. So I, you know what I mean? Like I definitely would be on board with the whole helicopter thing. So like, yeah, you can walk up through the underbrush. Having the right tool for the job can make all the difference in the world. And that applies for Western hunts too, especially if you're coming from the Midwest like myself. Because if you don't have it, there's no going home to get it. And that's why many of us Western hunters are also gear junkies. And the same is true for the folks over at Go Hunt. They have built the Go Hunt gear shop to be jam-packed full of the best, highest quality gear needed for your Western hunt. They try out everything that gets into the shop, and if they don't like it or they don't use it, it doesn't make the cut. So if you need something for your next trip, Go Hunt has something for you in the gear shop. They've got everything from optics, gear, camping accessories, apparel, footwear. They've got packs, and they've got some of the best brands in the industry. So if you're in the market for some new gear, consider checking out the Go Hunt gear shop. They're an avid supporter of the outdoors. They are supporters of this podcast, and most importantly, they're supporters of you. They want to help you be more successful in the West, so there's no better place to shop for gear, information, and knowledge than Go Hunt. And if you use the code WESTERN when you check out, you're going to get 10% off most of the regular priced items in the shop. So head over to GoHunt.com, get the gear you need, use the code WESTERN, and get the right tool for the job this fall. Or we can bring you there in a helicopter. I'm like, I'm going to do the helicopter. I'm going to do the helicopter. How much is the helicopter? Yeah, I'm going to do the helicopter. But you land, so you're probably not doing like the 12 hours in with all of camp on your backpack stuff, which would add a different element to your training regimen, I'm sure, right? You know, planning that 80 to 100-pound pack in.
And I had planned on that because sometimes, depending on where they drop you, they can drop you there and then you can go, you know. So you just didn't really know until you got up there and how your hunt was going to be. You know, especially being a young guy, you know, that they don't get a lot of super young people in camp, you know, like they're pretty excited to have a young buck in camp. So I didn't know what I was getting myself into as far as, was it going to be, they can drop me on a sheep, or is it going to be a 12-mile ruck and then we got to find them. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming they don't get a lot of young guys because it takes a lot of hours to save up. And if you don't have a lot of responsibilities, you can get a lot of those hours in two years. But if you're like, you know, got family and kids and a bunch of other things, it can take a lot longer to get those hours in. Or if you're, you know, in a career path where you just can't pick up overtime whenever you want, like me, I can work all day long, but I'm only getting paid for 8 hours of it. So, you know, I can't just keep working the overtime. So they're probably not used to someone coming out that's, you know, on the younger side and be like, oh, hey, let's go. Which, I don't know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? They're always going to be in better shape than you. So no matter how fit you are, they're still going to push you right to the red line.
Yep.
So is that what your experience was too? Like these guys just can't keep up with them if they want to leave you?
Yeah.
I mean, they're not going to because they're your guide. But like you're huffing and puffing and ready for a break and they're still jabbering away.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, and like you said, these guys get up there, and I think this was their fourth or fifth hunt of the year. I can't remember. So by then, they're top shape. They're the best they're going to be. And, things are starting to wind down sheep hunting, and they're getting ready to start transitioning into moose hunting. I think a hunt or two after mine. So, I mean, they were, their mindset was already starting to change just a little bit, it seemed like. So,
yeah. So do you think that helped you in any way or hurt you? So if you're one of the last hunts in camp, obviously other big rams have had opportunities to take, but they've also been there all fall, and they probably have a better idea of where rams are this year. And, you know, they're like, yeah, we've, you know, we've been seeing rams on this mountain all day long or all year long, but the guys in camp didn't want to go that way, or they couldn't get up there. Or what's your take on that?
I think if they're running their area like they should, it doesn't matter. You really? Know, because the basin that I hunted, and it was a pretty small basin, they hadn't been in there for like three or four years. You know, hadn't been hunted in 3 or 4 years.
Oh, so you did get like fresh ground.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, they don't hunt the same ground routinely. Sometimes they will, you know, depending if they know they have an age-appropriate ram, you know, because – with sheep hunting, it's all about age. You know, they don't want to shoot a giant full curl 7-year-old. You know, they don't want that. You're going to shoot the 12-year-old standing next to him, even if he's smaller. You know, that's just kind of the way it works with sheep hunting. You're going for age. So. Yeah.
So one of the things that I've always struggled with, I understand how to age a sheep, and I've looked at pictures and I'm like, man, there's no way I would feel confident in this. Doing this, like if I didn't have a guide there, it's telling me like, yeah, that one's legal. And you know, some units, it is about legality, not just, you know, quality herd management.
Yeah.
Did you struggle with it?
I struggle with it. You know, when they dropped me into the basin that we hunted, they straight up told me, they're like, there is not a lot of rams in this area. You're either going to find them tonight or tomorrow, or we're going to pick you up and we're going to move you.
Really?
Because it was such a low density area, but they knew there's mature rams in there. So it's like, you're going to either kill one here the next day and a half, or we're going to move you.
And is that what happened?
Yeah. Yeah. I shot my ram the first day.
Oh, wow. What'd you do for the rest of the trip then?
I went caribou hunting.
Oh, nice. That would be so cool. So I'm assuming the guide, you're looking at it and you're like, that's a big ram. And the guide's like, yeah, he's, you know, 11 and a half years old. And you're like, okay, cool. You know, you knew he was big, but the guide was the one that really confirmed it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it happened so fast too. You know, I glassed up this ram first thing in the morning. It looked like a wet rock just sticking up over the ridgeline. And I'm like, hey, Brady, take a look at this. Is that a ram over there? And sure enough, he got a look at it. I mean, you could just see the tops of it and they disappeared. And so then we ended up working around, coming up over them. Set up on top of this little basin 300 yards away, and then they never showed. You know, rainstorms come through, we're getting rained on, and next thing you know, he finds them across the canyon, pretty much where we were that morning.
Oh boy.
And he put his spotter up so quick and is like, we need to go kill that ram.
That's a shoot. Like, yeah, when your guide says it instantly, that's a good
tale. Didn't even let me look at it. He's like, we need to go kill him.
Wow.
Full curl one side, broomed on the other. He's like, he's a good ram, we need to go kill him.
So what's broomed mean? Past full curl?
So big rams, once they get certain age, they like to rub one side, because I from what I've heard, they can start seeing it in their peripheral vision.
Oh.
And they rub it, so it's essentially when it gets, they rub it off. Okay. It's just not that nice lamb tip, you know, so it's essentially kind of broken off, wore off. So
but it's still big and heavy and like the age.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's part of the reason why I've always struggled to measure them or to age them. Like I can count the first two rings on your ram behind you from here, but the ones out on the tip where it's like, well, first of all, they broke off. So, you know, the guides can be like, yeah, but he would have had two more. And I'm like, I don't know. Like how many would he have had? And so that's the part. And then sometimes they're like, is that just is that a growth ring or is that just a line? I mean, imagine if you're doing a DIY in Alaska, or there's a couple places you can do DIY. And if there are rules, I think a lot of times it's like 10-year-old rams.
Is 10 year or gotta be certain, like Alaska, it's I think 10 or past full curl.
Right. So it's like,
I think
he's not past full curl. He's broomed. I count, I think, 9 rings, and he probably would have had another. Just man, I can't imagine the stress. And everyone takes sheep hunting very seriously, right? Like, you know, breaking the rules is a non-starter for any game animal, really. But there's a lot of scrutiny on the sheep because they're such a valuable resource, and they are very, I don't want to say endangered. They're not endangered, but their populations don't explode like a whitetail in the Midwest, right? Like, there's a lot of pressure to keep this resource available. And so, yeah, I would be terrified. I would be shooting things. It's like, I'm pretty sure it's got 12, which means it probably really has 11, and it's 4 inches past full curl, which means it's probably actually at full curl, but I got a lot of margin here. This is a good one, which that would be a monster ram anyway. So probably not going to find that on my DIY hunt.
The nice thing about Northwest Territory, one, I was outfitted, so I trust my guide.
Yeah.
Second, they actually don't have a legal age or full curl there.
Yeah.
The state just lets the outfitters
handle it. Yeah.
Yeah. They trust them. That's the way it's been because they've done so well at managing for age. I want to say last year their average ram was 10. So I think my ram was 11 and a half. So
that's awesome. And so for the folks watching the video or the clips, they'll see it. It's behind you there on display. So you did the Euro mount. I'm interested in hearing from you. So I feel like there's been a little bit of not controversy or debate, but maybe a little bit of a newer understanding or a new practice, common practice maybe is the best way to say it. So if I shoot a giant whitetail, right, I'm shoulder mounting it. If I shoot a giant elk, I'm shoulder mounting it. I feel like it's very common nowadays for guys that shoot big rams to not shoulder mount them because they want to be able to pick the Euro up and just like, you know, really take in how big it is and how heavy it is. So is that kind of where you were going with it as well?
So yes. So this is the original ram, the original horns, original Euro, but I did get a replica made, and that's going to go on the full body mount.
Yeah. So that's what I've been hearing a lot of people do is they keep the original on their desk or at work or wherever. Yep. And that way when someone, you know, I imagine, well, first of all, I probably wouldn't keep a just loose on my desk at work. That sounds a little dangerous, but you know, when someone comes back, you go, yeah, pick that up. And they're like, okay, holy shit. They're expecting like a heavy whitetail, and it's not. It's really heavy. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then they do the replica for the full body, which is – where did you go to get the replica made for your full body? Did you have to get like a full cast, or did you do some type of like 3D scanning?
No, so there's I'm using Dewey's Taxidermy for my full body.
Okay.
And they work very closely with a group there in Cody. So I think it's Backcountry Decor. That's all they do. All they do is replicas for sheep. So they do a ton of them.
That's awesome.
And it turned out incredible. Yeah. They sent me pictures of it, and it's like it's perfect. So
that is so cool. How did you, I've always been curious about how skinning an animal in the field, caping it for a full body goes. So is it just like, you got to really make sure every cut is perfect, or did the guide handle that?
I let the guide handle that. You know, I was there and helping hold stuff, but I mean, so my guide was, Brady. He's, Brady Lowell. He's been big time sheep hunter. He's younger than me, I think mid 30s. Yeah. And this was his 80th ram that he was a part of. So I let the professional hand the full body cape because he did such an amazing job. I mean, it looked not a lick of extra meat on it. It was like perfect. Yeah.
So is it pretty basically incredible. Just up the back or the inside of each leg, you go to the last joint, and then does he just cut the whole hoof right off and you bring the whole hoof out?
Yeah, and they went a little further. Like they actually get the bones out of the actual hoof back at camp. Like, I mean, it's pretty incredible what they can do with those things.
And then
they salt them all up there up in Millinower. They salt them all, hang them, dry them, resalt them. It's pretty incredible what they do.
Also, with the helicopter, you can drop in yeah. enough salt. Yeah. I don't know if I'd want to carry well, out the softener salt bag with me.
This is at base camp. You know, this is at base camp, which has all the typical amenities, you know. So
oh,
this is
so
at base
got,
camp.
Like,
they
their
that.
Cabin and their lodges mm-hmm. and everything. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So, yeah, they've got plenty of resources there. And then they just go up and they do they just make like two Y cuts, you know, go up both legs, Y it to the belly line. And then from there, everything is just peeled off, kind of like
yeah,
a normal.
Right up the back, typical. I want to say they wired it, but I mean, those horns are so massive. I mean, there's only a half inch between the horns.
Oh,
know?
So they went down the spine
mm-hmm.
and then that was the only cut down the spine. Yep. And then everything else was kind of.
We just peeled it out.
Peeled it out. Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, gotcha. I was thinking maybe from the underneath, but yeah, that
nope,
makes more sense.
Right up the center of the back.
That's how I do it for elk. I've caped two bulls for shoulder mounting, and I did the, but I just stopped, you know, at the. I probably actually saved enough hide to mount four elk. I was told by my taxidermist, like, "Hey, you saved way too much hide, by the way." And I'm like, "That's why I was so heavy."
I'd rather have too much than not enough. So,
well, for the one, it was like, yeah, 350-inch bull. I'm not messing this up.
No.
Yeah. And I know why I drop my heads off when I can and let them cape the face. Caping that elk face out when I knew, like, I do not want to make a mistake. I'll do it again if I have to, but, man, if there's any opportunity, just give it to a taxidermist. I'm like, this is why I pay you, man. Like, I don't want to mess this up. And this is – it's not easy, especially when you really care.
Well, and an elk's a little different than a mule deer or a whitetail, you know. That little gland they got in their nose is just –
oh, it took
know.
Me probably at least 30 minutes to an hour to get the eye and the gland out.
Yep.
Yeah,
not
it was
as
tough.
Easy.
The end of it's easy. You know, once you can get into the gums and like in the nose, that stuff wasn't as bad. But yeah, getting around the horns, the ears, you know, and the eyes, just making sure you're not cutting off anything you need.
Yeah.
That part was pretty sketchy. So you finished your sheep hunt early. So I have a buddy. Loose acquaintance. My brother's pretty good friends with him. He got a sheep slam. He did it with a bow.
Wow.
But he took him, I can't remember, it was 46 or 47 days of hunting for a first shot opportunity at his stone ram. Four trips. Wow. It took him four trips. And so, I mean, I know stone is, every sheep is different. You know, his desert sheep, I think he shot it on the second day of his beach vacation in Mexico. Like, it was a different hunt, right? And he knew he saved that one for the last because he knew it would be easier. But the other three are in British Columbia. And I'm just imagine that much time. And it usually is a lot of time to get in on them. So a day in, you're probably thinking, like, this is unreal. Like, can't imagine. Was the plan always, like, if we tag out early, I'll do caribou, but we probably won't tag out early? Or what was the kind of the thought process there?
I paid for a caribou tag up front, you know? Okay. So yeah, they have pretty high success rates. You know, I didn't expect to fill one so quickly, but it just happened to work out that way. So
yeah. So then you got plenty of time to caribou hunt. So then did you slow down at all? And you're like, okay, we got 8 days left. And I'm caribou hunting. Like, I'm going to take my time now. I'm going to, you know, make sure it's a good one, or, you know.
I probably should have, because I shot my caribou the first day too.
Oh, wow. So did you take a day in between to kind of get back to camp, get things settled, you know?
Yep. So they bring you back to base camp. So I guess second day of hunting, after I filled my sheep tag, they flew me back into base camp.
You've heard me talk about how I use my Arctic coolers in a modular system to make sure I have the exact cooler and size I need for whatever application I'm doing. I don't like taking a bunch of truck space and using it on too many coolers, and I definitely don't like to be light on coolers so I can't keep my wild game cold on the way home. But one of the things I haven't really talked about is all the accessories Arctic has to really take a modular system to the next level. All of the coolers that I use, whether it's the Ultralight 72 on wheels or the Ultratuf 110 or Ultratuf 145, come with the option to get dividers. Some of the dividers are even freezable, and it makes it super easy to keep all of my things organized in my cooler. I separate my drinks from my food, from some of the snacks, and it makes it easy to grab exactly what I want out of each of them. They also come with a whole host of accessories. From baskets to keep your dry goods out of the ice, to wagons to easily transport those bigger Ultra Tough series coolers and even cushions to make owning a cooler enjoyable again. No more digging to the bottom of the ice, cutting up your fingers, and making your hands freezing cold just to try to find that last Coors Light or the ketchup bottle. Go check out the coolers in the link in our show notes. Head to the description and scroll down. You're going to see all of our sponsor and discount information, and we've got a link for you that's going to take you over and show you all the sweet accessories Arctic has to offer, and you're going to see why owning an Arctic cooler makes it enjoyable again to be bringing roto-molded coolers with you wherever you go.
Camp stayed there for the day, and then the following day they flew me out to Caribou. And then I guess what was it, when the fourth day that I was up there, is when I shot my caribou. Yeah. Oh, nice. Probably should have held out a little bit. You just never know what's going to come.
Well, the caribou you shot know? Was a monster too. So it's not like you could have just watched him for 5 days and still shot him.
And honestly, we were just like, we're just going to get close and see what happens. You know, we spotted him from camp, you know, we moved 200 yards up just to see what happens. And next thing you know, it's like, huh. He's 300 yards. Yeah. Oh, now he's 200 yards. Oh, now he's 170. It's like, he looks pretty nice.
Yeah.
So
you've shot two caribou, right?
Yep. So yeah. My caribou up in Northwest Territories was mountain caribou. And then I also shot a barren ground caribou in Alaska.
Was the barren ground the hard-horned one?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, that's crazy. So the caribou, they're, I've been told they're like a large mule deer. Is that kind of the size you'd put, like, not as, like, bigger than a mule deer, but not an elk?
I would say they're perfectly sized between a big mule deer and an elk.
Okay, so.
So like, they're bigger than a big mule deer. I would
400, say. 450 pounds on the hoof. I think yeah. Most elk people shoot are like 600.
I mean, it's definitely bigger than a mule deer, for sure. Yeah. But definitely smaller than an elk.
Yeah, I'd say like a big mule deer is probably running around 300 pounds on the hoof. A lot of people like to say they shoot 1,000-pound elk and have 100-pound quarters, and I just don't see it. I mean, I don't know. I've never weighed a whole elk. I'm sure people have, and there probably are 1,000-pound elk out there, but it wasn't the Red Horn Timmy shot.
Exactly.
Or the Red Horn we shoot in, you know, Montana, not to be hard on anyone out there named Timmy, but it's not, I don't think it's as common as people think. I think Wikipedia says big bulls can get up to 1,000 pounds, and then everyone assumes they all weigh that.
Okay. I think Roosevelts are the biggest bodied, aren't they?
I've heard that, and I've heard specifically like the Roosevelts on like Southeast Alaska, like a Fogniak and Prince of Wales Island, like those suckers I've heard are big.
Yeah.
But the one I shot was 8.5 years old. He was he grew up on wheat and corn and irrigated alfalfa, no predators, no bears, private land, mild winters. I mean, he was fat. I shot him September 8th. So beginning of the rut, you know, peak body weight, I would say. And he had 82 pound rear quarters.
And wow.
It's the biggest elk I've ever been a part of. It's not the biggest elk ever. I mean, there's lots of giant elk that get shot every year, but me personally, was 100% without a doubt the biggest elk I've ever, anyone in our group has ever shot, body size wise and antler size, but we're talking body here. And I was still 20 pounds short. I mean, and it's not just 20 pounds, I was 25%. Like he would have had been 25% bigger, which I just don't see a lot of them doing that. I don't know.
No.
Yeah, to get a 100-pound quarter. I don't think that's very common. So,
like you said,
the caribou that you shot. How did the meat aspect of the sheep and the caribou hunt work out? I'm very interested. I've heard good things about caribou. I've heard a lot of different things about sheep. So I want to hear it straight from the source on just like packing it out, maybe eating it first in camp, what that was like, you know, eating it. Did you bring any home? You know, sometimes people donate it to local communities. How'd that all work out?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the hard part with these trips, you know, because it's logistics-wise, how do you get it home, right?
Yeah.
My big thing is like, I mean, like, obviously, this is a bit of a trophy hunt, you know. It was kind of one of those things I wanted to do, but I am a meat hunter. I mean, I eat everything I kill, so I did struggle a little bit with this trip. I had planned to bring a cooler of sheep and caribou meat home. But given the circumstances of what was going on last year this time, aka the big wildfires they were having,
yeah,
I wasn't able to bring any meat home, which stinks. It all got donated or eaten in camp. But yeah, there was giant wildfires. They actually evacuated the entire town. Gosh, I can't remember it now. Where our commercial flights were through.
Okay.
So they weren't sure how I was even going to get home.
Oof.
So I actually had to get flown home through the Yukon. So I actually, they chartered a separate flight for me so I could get home. So out through the Yukon.
Oh, so they chartered you to the Yukon, and then you're like, once you get there, you're going to hop on Alaskan Airlines and figure it out, you know. So it's not like they chartered a Boeing 737 for you. They chartered
I mean, this is a small beaver plane that landed on the lake. They picked us up. There was one other hunter and I, and we flew to Yellowknife to get home. So it was pretty interesting, that little flight,
the beaver was the plane that, like, you couldn't bring a 200-pound cooler full of meat on?
Unfortunately. Yeah. They're like, we're just thankful to get you home. I didn't even have my gun case. I had to take a gun case from one of the outfitters, from one of the guides.
Because of weight?
To get my gun home. No, because of weight. So your locked gun case that you fly commercially with was left at the base camp of the air charter company. And it was a separate air charter company that brought me into the Yukon.
Oh, so did you get it back, or did you just trade?
Nope.
Be like, they're going to give you.
I did a trade.
Yeah. Did you come out ahead on the trade, or?
No, you're going to laugh at this. So I double, triple checked the lock combo on this gun case, throw my gun in it. I go to check in my gun the morning of flying home. Combo is not working. And I'm like, oh, what am I going to do? Security's going to have to look in this case.
Yeah.
And thank God they never did, because I could not get it open, and I had to break into this gun case when I got home.
Oh, boy. So, yeah, now you have a gun case, which is a bummer. Kind of small peanuts in the grand scope of your adventure, right? I mean, that's really off in the fuzz. But still, yeah, that is crazy. You would have had to buy another one in town there. And
I don't know what I would have done. Because, I mean, customs coming back into the States never opened it and looked at it. So, I mean, there was a lot of hiccups that could have happened. So,
was this the first trip that you've flown with a firearm?
No, for our Alaska trip, I flew with a firearm as well.
Oh, that one was first. Okay.
Yeah. The Alaska caribou was in, what was that, 2020, I believe. So,
how was the first time you flew with a firearm, you know, can you give us a little bit of insight? Because I think that's, I would say, probably one of the premier hurdles to people hunting in Alaska is they don't know. It seems scary to fly with a firearm, in addition to all the other things. New state, you know, Alaskan Airlines, bush pilots, trying to line everything up, the logistics. But that's one thing that I think a lot of people kind of get hung up on as well, and myself included. I don't know how to fly with a firearm. So it'd be very interesting to hear, you know, how you learned what to do, how it went. Did you get cavity searched or not? You don't have to tell us about it.
Yeah. Honestly, it's pretty straightforward, you know.
Okay.
Especially if you're flying in the States, it's super easy, you know, because you don't have to have any proof of anything. It's your gun. They don't look for background checks or nothing like that. Every airlines has their policy protocols, what you got to do. Mm-hmm. Rifles are different than pistols, is how they're supposed to be secured. You know, but obviously everything's got to be locked. It's got to be in a hard side case, and it's got to be locked. That's the main thing.
And does ammo have to be separate than the firearm?
It does not. No.
Not have to. Just look at the rules, but
I want to say in the US it does not, but in Canada it did need to be.
Okay.
Canada had to be in separate, and it has to be in a hard side. Can't be loose leaf ammo. It's got to be in either a manufacturer's case or a hard side case if you reload. Like a hard side box, I guess.
So you can't have a Ziploc bag full of bullets.
Nope.
you have to put it in like a plastic or a metal, like could it be in like an ammo can, you know, like the big ammo can loose? That,
I don't think so.
Yeah. It's gotta be so singulated. Yeah. It's gotta be in a singulated, you know, container, like individual slots for each bullet in a box. And then does that box have to be in like a Pelican bag, or could it be in like okay.
I want to say I had my ammo just in my regular check bag.
Yeah.
Just in the factory box.
Okay. Yeah, factory box to me seems like the way to go. Even if you reload, go find a factory box and put it in there. Be like, this is nothing's goofy here.
Yep.
Don't be like Brian's super secret, you know, top secret bullets. I wouldn't be doing any of that.
Well, I mean, one guy that I met on this sheep hunt, he had his in like a little bullet wallet, you know, like a fold up bullet wallet that sits in his front pocket. He ran into issues up in Canada. They had to inspect all his stuff because it looked like loose leaf ammo via their x-rays. So it's like that was a pain in the butt for him.
Oh, because it looked like he just had four bullets in his pocket, I bet.
Yep.
I'll tell you what looks really suspicious on x-rays. When you fly with an aluminum case of poker chips, because all the poker chips are in like straight lines, like coils. And then you have like this deck of cards in the top that's like a little tiny square in the center and a couple of odds and ends. It's like, they search that real fast. There is alarms going off.
That might look like something.
I just wanted to play poker in Mexico.
Yeah, it might look like something that goes boom. So
yeah, and you're like, oh, yeah, don't do that. Sorry.
Whoops.
Yeah, sorry. When we came back, I was like, hey, there's a poker set in there. You just want to look at that before it goes through the x-ray. I think I pulled it out, actually, going home. And so then it was like no one pulls out their bomb and puts it through the x-ray machine. So that helped a lot. Okay, so you've flown a couple times. The caribou, so when you ate the meat in camp, can kind of get back to the original question, how was the sheep?
It was awesome, yeah.
Really? So steaks, I'm assuming, was like the first thing.
Yeah, they cooked some steaks in camp. You know, obviously they have like a amazing cook there. You know, I mean, you could give him anything and he's going to make it taste amazing. So
okay.
It would have been interesting for me to cook some on my own, how I cook all my meat at home, you know.
Was it did you notice anything special about the way he did it? Was it like low and slow? Was it, you know, you marinated him first or anything? No.
He cooked it hot and fast on the grill is what he did. So
hot and fast. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Did it have a flavor that you can tell, like, this is not whitetails from Nebraska?
I mean, it's hard to say, you know. I mean, our whitetails here are pretty dang good. They're corn fed. So, I mean,
right.
It's hard to beat our whitetails here in Nebraska. I feel like they taste amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Midwest whitetails, I would say, are like the baseline of wild game that you compare everything to, right? And mule deer, you're like, yeah, they take a little sagier than, you know, whitetails. And, you know, bull elk, yeah, they taste a little, you know, a little gamier than a whitetail. And then antelope, a lot of times, like, yeah, a little bit less, actually. I don't know. It seemed a little bit, you know, milder. And then, you know, you can get good bad whitetails, depending on how you take care of the meat. But it's like everything, that's the common, and everyone's had it. So everyone knows what you're talking about.
Yep.
Yeah, if you're like, yeah, it was a little more tender than a sheep. You're like, well, I have no idea how tough a sheep is. So, what are you trying to tell me? So that was good. And then the caribou, was the caribou a lot more like an elk or a mule deer?
Caribou is an interesting one for me. You know, they're good. They're tender. They're almost too tender. It's very strange. You know, they just, to me, with the ones we shot in Alaska and this one in Northwest Territory, I mean, when you cook them, it's just like straight mush. You know, when you're chewing them, it's like they're so tender, they just fall apart in your mouth.
Really interesting.
Yeah, it's very strange. Yeah, I've never had meat like that. It tastes amazing, tastes really good, but it's like, it's very tender.
You know, I've heard from a few people on the podcast and just, you know, hearing other people talk about caribou hunting, that they are soft animals.
Like, yeah.
Hey, folks. I've been hunting out of Booner panel blinds by Maverick for years now. And one of my favorite things about the Booner blinds and all of Maverick's hunting blinds is how easy they are to set up. I recently set up two new blinds this last season, and I had both blinds set up by myself without any heavy equipment. you can carry each panel of your blind to the top of your platform and set it up by yourself in a single day. The best part about Maverick hunting blinds is that you get the all-weather comfort and scent control benefits of a hard-sided blind at a fraction of the cost. I mean, you can literally get three Maverick hunting blinds for the same price as some of the other options on the market, meaning you get triple the options when it comes to picking where you want to hunt so you can be in the right stand when that big buck walks out this fall. Click the link below and head over to maverickhunting.com and use the code WESTERNROOKIE, that's one word, WESTERNROOKIE, to save 10% on your next blind. Anything you do, like, they lay down, right? You put a bad shot on them, they still tip over. You know, kind of like antelope in a way. Like, you shoot antelope, they tip over. I've heard people say that. I don't know if it's true or not.
I have the opposite feeling on caribou, because the caribou I shot in Alaska took about 7 bullets for me, and I ran out of ammo, and I was hitting it every single time. And same with the one up in NWT. I put 2 or 3 rounds in it, and I mean, on film, you can see it hitting him just perfect, and he just took every shot and just stood there.
What are you shooting, Full Metal Jackets here?
I'm shooting 7 mag.
Yeah.
And I think the first caribou I was shooting 162 grain ELDX, and I want to say, I think last year I was shooting 150 grain. Can't remember what I'm shooting now, but
so maybe not true everywhere, but yeah, that was a couple people's insights. It's like, yeah, it seemed like caribou are just soft compared to elk. You know, they're comparing it to elk. I mean, those elk just want to survive.
That's fair.
Yeah. Interesting. So when it comes to hunting, I don't know. I use the term trophy hunting too, because it's easy, but it gets such a bad rap, and I feel like it's not trophy hunting. I would say it's maybe adventure hunting would be a different way to describe it. Like, it's a once in a lifetime adventure that you're going on, irregardless, because you would still be like, this was an awesome hunt if you didn't bring anything home. Right. And so
absolutely,
when it comes to some of these adventure hunts, would you rank like the Alaska caribou experience as like a pretty approachable way to get into like flying into some remote country, hunting Alaska, maybe compared to other things like sheep, moose that you've kind of, you know, you've been on the periphery of, you know, talking to the outfitters and stuff? Is that one that's like, if you're a DIY guy and you're just looking to start hunting Alaska, would you recommend like, yeah, start with a caribou hunt, or start with a, what would you be your like, start with this species?
I mean, honestly, I even think a spring bear hunt, like I've done a spring bear hunt in Canada as well. That was a really good intro. Okay. Not as hardcore, not as maybe adventurous as a caribou hunt, but they're reasonably priced. You travel with a weapon, you know, it's a really good intro at realistically probably half the price of a caribou hunt right now. So, I mean, that's a really good intro. But if a guy wants adventure, middle of nowhere, caribou is a really good way to do it, for sure. Yeah.
I'm a big advocate of kind of like experience stacking in a way. And it comes into, I think, a lot more commonly with lower 48, right? A lot of people want to get into the Western hunting thing, and they ask you like, I want to do this. I'm going to do my first Western elk hunt, or my first Western hunt. It's an archery elk hunt, 14 days in the backcountry. I'm like, oof. You are about to learn a lot of stuff really fast. Like,
they'll make it about 4 days.
Yeah. I don't know. I still haven't found a way to elegantly handle that, what you're talking about. Like, I don't want to tell people, I don't want to poop on their ideas and their dreams, but I also don't want to just be like, you're going to have a blast. Good luck. But I always recommend, like, if you start with if you start with rifle antelope, you're learning how to get out west. You're learning how to navigate roads. You're learning how to camp. You're learning some spot and stock skills, some glassing skills, you know, maybe longer range shooting skills. You're learning a lot of things that can apply on your next hunt without having to learn everything. When you're doing like alpine mule deer or, you know, rifle or archery elk, you're learning it all at once. And you don't have to. You don't necessarily have to learn everything at once. You don't have to learn how to quarter and pack out on a 1,000-pound animal. I was just going to say itself, but a 650-pound elk, you can learn on a 150-pound antelope. And if it doesn't go well, you're not killing yourself because it's only an antelope quarter, not an elk quarter. Those types of things. And then working your way up. Archery antelope, I would say, is very difficult. I would not recommend starting with that unless you have a guide or private land or you're going with a group that knows what they're doing. And the going with the group thing kind of applies to anything. If you've got a group that's been going and they know what they're doing, then you can really jump in anywhere. But if you're trying to figure it out for yourself, I'm a real big advocate of starting on the first rung and then work your way up as you go, as you experience it. Kind of at your own pace. Like, some people might be like, yeah, that was super easy, I'm jumping two rungs up next time. Some people be like, no, this is where I want to be. I don't want to have to walk in 10 miles. I don't want to have to pack up. I don't want to have to be concerned with where I'm getting water. You know, all these other things that you might have to learn if you're going to be doing that 14-day backcountry archery elk hunt. And I just, I don't know. I feel like it's a better experience. First of all, antelope hunting is awesome. I mean, you do it yourself. Like, it's type one fun the whole time.
Yep.
So that's what I was kind of looking for the Alaska version of that. Like, what's a good one to start with? And this, I think, yeah, spring bear seems really approachable too. Lots of game. You're going to probably see a bear. Like, that's number one. You go on a moose hunt, you might not see a moose.
Exactly. Yep.
And that can be discouraging for someone's first trip.
Caribou can be the same way though. If you time the migration right, you do. If you don't, you don't. So.
I feel like that's such a funny one because it's been going on for like thousands of years and it's the same, you know, same thing every year, maybe not the exact same slope or the exact. And I feel like, you know, the Native Americans probably had this dialed to a T because they lived on it. And then for us, we're still with all the technology and resources and experience we have, we're still like, yep, missed it. Sorry. you know what I mean? Like, we still don't know when it's going to be.
That is, it's so true. I mean, even when we were up there, I mean, it's caribou hunts are a quick 5 days of hunting, you know, a day of travel on the front end, a day of travel on the back end, but it's 5 days of hunting. So, I mean, time goes quick, you know, and if they're not moving or if it's bad weather, it's hit and miss, you know.
Yeah.
They don't always migrate in one direction, you know. We saw them going every direction, you know. Majority were heading, it seemed like south. But, I mean, every once in a while, they're going the other way. So there's really no rhyme or reason, it felt like, to what the heck they were doing.
Yeah. And were you camping, like, spike camping, backpack hunting, or were you, like, doing more of a base camp, you know, in the truck every day, checking out a spot?
For a caribou?
Yeah, the last caribou.
So we did a drop camp. So they flew us in on a remote lake, and we were, I don't know how many miles away from town, but we were a long ways out. But we decided to do a drop camp, you know, where we use their gear, not our own. It just logistics of getting, you know, three guys gear up to Alaska. That's a lot of gear, you know. We already had a lot of gear, so I mean, to not have to worry about tent, stove, food, any of that stuff was huge. So all we had to show up was our weapon, our sleeping pad, and our actual clothing was huge.
Oh, they had everything else, like sleeping bag, cot.
We had to do sleeping bag, but they had the cots.
Okay, yeah, that would be big. Did they have the bear
fence?
Which
is nice. They did not have a bear fence. I wish we would have had a bear fence.
Did you have bears in camp?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We lost about half our caribou meat to bears. We had one come into camp middle of the night. We had an extra gear tent that we had, and he tore right into it. Middle of the night, 20 yards from where we were sleeping.
Yeah. Did you wake up when it was happening?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Because they're pretty loud.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I came home with some PTSD after that trip. So,
you had spray, right? Did you have?
No, we had pistols and we had our rifles.
Oh,
we probably legally could have killed that bear, but by the time we got out there, he was gone. He was back on our meat pile at that point.
Oh, you tried to get up and haze him off and be like,
we
hey,
were
get out of here.
We were going to, yeah. But by the time we got out there, he was back on the meat pile.
Did you have food in that tent? Any food items?
We had our bloody backpacks in there. So that's probably what it was.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is weird. He goes after a bloody backpack while we have three dead caribou at the time, 75 yards from that tent.
When we hunt grizzly country, we don't even leave toothpaste in our tents.
Yeah.
Which, yep. That's our, I mean, nothing. Nothing.
But it's like, I smell more ripe than that toothpaste does.
Yeah, but you smell like danger, not food to him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, grizzlies are a little different than those Arctic bears, though, too. So,
yeah, I'm sure the brown bears are like, yeah, I don't know. But it's still not like, oh, I've eaten this thing every day. I know this is food. They're like, I don't know. And I think most wild animals default on caution when they come to new things. Unless it's a sow with cubs, then they default to kill it. But
yeah.
A solo bear smells something new, like a human it hasn't smelt in a few years. I think they default to caution. Not necessarily afraid, but they're not like coming right in to eat you because they don't really know what that is. But yeah, no, that's interesting. I don't know. I want to do Alaska someday. There's a lot to learn, a lot of things to pick up on before I get there.
Ah, just do it. Just book it and figure it out. I'm telling you.
That's Cody Ritchie. We just had Cody Ritchie on the podcast. He's like, book the hunt and then figure out how to pay for it.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these guys are willing to work with you too. You know, it's like, hey, I can only afford to put this down. You know, let's just figure it out. A lot of guys, they're willing to do it. You know, you don't, the nice thing is a lot of them, the standard tends to be about 50% of the hunt is what a lot of them ask for. You know, every outfit's different, but I mean, when you can plan a couple years out, it makes it a whole lot easier to, you know, swallow when it comes to paying. So
for sure, for sure. One of the things I wanted to talk to you before we end the podcast. So you are on a quest for your North American Super 10. So there's a lot of different, you know, there's the big game slam, a turkey slam, a sheep slam, the grand slam. What's the Super 10? I don't know if I've heard that one explained yet.
Yeah. So ultimately, I would love to do the North American Slam, you know. But like
the big game Grand Slam, the 29 animals or 31 animals?
It fluctuates, 28, 29, depending. I think there's one caribou that you can't legally hunt anymore. But so, yeah, growing up, I grew up reading Chuck Adams, you know.
Yeah.
Chuck Adams Super Slam book, you know. I think I have it on the bookshelf back here still, you know. And that's what I grew up reading, you know. I'd love to do that, but realistically, financially, there's no way I can do it, you know. And do I really want to kill a polar bear? No, I don't. I can't bring that trophy home. You can't import that to the U.S. It's like I'm going for adventure, you know. And so instead of doing all 29, the Big Ten, so it's the North American Big Ten, it's essentially one animal from each species, you know.
So how does the cervids work out then?
Oh, geez. It's one of the bears, one cat. Sorry, I'm looking at my cheat sheet here. One deer, one elk, one caribou, one moose, either a bison or a muskox. It can be one or the other.
Okay.
A mountain goat, an antelope, and then one of the sheep.
Okay. So the cervids, it's not like you shoot a white-tailed doe and it counts for all of your, you know, elk, moose, mule deer, antelope.
So it's one from each category of the Super Slam.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yep. Yeah, so you don't have to do like a Rosie and a Rocky Mountain elk. You don't have to do a Shiros and a Yukon or a Canadian.
Yep. Now, if you want sheep, Super Slam, it's all of them.
The sheep one would be the part. Sheep would be definitely hard.
Yep.
The muskox bison isn't easy. There's not a slam dunk there. Moose can be challenging. I mean, you get there's opportunities, but it's still not guarantees.
Yep.
You know, the only one that sounds like a guarantee on the list is the deer and the antelope. Like, you can do that every year.
Deer, antelope, elk. I mean, those are all very manageable.
Yeah.
You know, as far as
you're 7 out of the 10 you got.
I'm 7
right now.
Out of the 10. Yep.
So I'm going to try to guess. Mountain goat, the muskox bison, mountain lion. Are those the three?
You got the muskox bison. I don't have one of those.
Okay.
I don't have my moose. I have killed a mountain goat.
Oh, you did get a mountain goat.
I did. I drew a tag when I was still a Colorado resident. So.
Oh, you got lucky.
Yes, I did.
That's awesome. I love drawing tags like that. Or, I mean, I would just say lucky because a lot of people apply their whole life and never draw, right? And I love when people are like, yeah, I drew this on the random side of, you know, zero, you know, you probably, what is it, like 3 points and then it becomes random?
Yeah, it's essentially, it's so 3 points gets you into the draw, and then the more bonus points you get, I think you essentially get a little bit extra odds. Your name goes in the hat, an extra couple times or something like that.
But you're basically not going to draw until three.
Yeah, you know, guarantee you won't draw until at least three. Yeah.
Awesome. So the moose, the, I don't know, what are we calling those? The wild bovines?
Yeah, I guess.
And then what's the third one?
So I'm missing moose, I'm missing bison or muskox, and a mountain lion. I don't have a mountain lion yet.
Okay, so I was got the mountain lion. Swapped out the – I just was like, mountain goat seems like a once-in-a-lifetime thing as well, so I assumed you didn't have that one. But
That's a fair guess.
Well, you've whittled it down to a manageable list. I think, like, a mountain lion is approachable, especially, like, you just got to find – probably the right resources, the right help of guys, you know, whether you do dogs or not. But, you know, it's not like the bison muskox one. That one might need some planning.
Yeah. I mean, you could go and do a ranch bull. I think they count some ranch bison, but it's like, what am I doing this for? Am I trying to check a box here? Which ultimately I kind of am, but yeah. I'm after this for adventure. You know, it's like, screw it. Right. I want to go shoot a muskox in -40-degree weather and just be miserable.
Yeah. I've thought about doing like a ranch bison hunt just for like basically like a grocery trip, right? Like, we're out of meat. We did not shoot very many animals this year. Like, we could go spend $1,500 and go shoot a cow bison on a ranch, which isn't super cool, but it'd be more fun than going to a meat locker and buying $1,500 worth of beef.
You better buy a couple more freezers if you're going to do that.
I've got three.
Then you might be okay then.
Then they're big. I got a full like 20 cubic upright. I got like a 21 cubic foot chest freezer. Yeah. I mean, it's just full size. It's not that big, but yeah.
Yeah.
And then I got the kitchen half, you know, the bottom freezer and the kitchen half. And I got the freezer portion of my beer fridge in the garage. So
that's how reserved for beer though.
Yeah, but not the freezer half.
Like that's fair.
The freezer top part, it's got tallow in it right now, actually, for mixing, grinding, which I should probably look at how old that stuff is. I don't know how long tallow lasts in the freezer, but.
Are you using beef or pork?
I've done both. This is beef, usually beef with our ground meat for like tacos and spaghetti and stuff. And then I'll use pork for if I'm making like snack sticks or brats or something like that, I'll buy pork butts and cut them up and grind them myself. It seems the cheapest way to do it.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. We got a free hookup for the beef tallow. So that works out pretty well. Where we had it, might not anymore. My dad retired, so we might have lost our connection.
Check out your local grocery store here. They'll give that crap away, man.
Yeah. And I have a buddy that has a jerky company, Rowan. I think it's Rowan Smokehouse. He makes all of his jerky from flank steaks. And so he trims off all the fat. And he was selling me the fat for $1 a piece or $1 a pound, which isn't terrible. I could probably work him down a little bit. I just transferred it. Bought it from him for $1 a pound, drove it back home to Fargo when I was living in North Dakota and sold it for $1 a pound. I was just a mule.
<That's>
Important fat.
Yeah, not even making money off it.
No, I was already going for a work trip, so somebody wanted it. I just picked it up for him. But no, that's awesome, man. You got a lot of adventures under your belt and you're still a young guy. Is it what's next on the radar? You did mention you got a little one at home. So is it kind of slowing down and spacing out a little bit now?
A little bit, you know, I mean, we have a 20-month-old and we're expecting another one here this right around Christmas time. So life's definitely changing, you know, but luckily my wife is very understanding. She gets it. You know, I made it very clear early on, like, hey, this is what I like to do. You know, so she supports it. She gets it. She understands. So it works out pretty well for us. But
has she gotten the bug at all?
Not really. You know, okay. She shot a couple turkeys and she shot a buck out at the farm here a few years back. But she not really. You know, which is fine. I'm not going to push her. You know.
Yeah.
So
Well,
it's got to be her idea.
It is a good thing, but you know, my wife is getting the bug. She likes hunting. We're doing antelope this year. She shot a buck on our farm with her bow last year. She's talking about elk hunting. And so where it becomes a problem is on these venture hunts, it's not like, can I afford to go shoot a sheep? It's, can we afford to do two sheep?
Two.
Or can we afford to do two moose? That's where it becomes a kicker and why I'm becoming a very fast advocate for learning how to do DIY Alaska versus saving up for the moose take. Because, man, if we were going to do two of them, it'd probably take years. And by then, it's probably another $15,000, $20,000 a piece to get, you know what I mean, for doing the outfitter. And you're still not guaranteed anything. Nothing is guaranteed hunting. Just because an outfitter's got a 99% shot opportunity doesn't mean it's guaranteed you're going to get one.
No.
And so, yeah, I just think if you can do DIY for a couple thousand bucks a pop, and you can do that every other year, every 3 years or whatever, I think it's just a better opportunity over the course of a lifetime to have some good memories.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's kind of where I land on it. Oh, maybe I'm just cheap.
No, it's smart. So
awesome.
Well, as far as the next big trip, sorry to interrupt you there.
Oh yeah.
I do have a Kodiak trip lined up for next year. So heading back to Kodiak for blacktail next year. So,
oh, that'll be fun. Definitely want to bring your electric fence for that one.
Well, we're staying on a boat, so that's nice. Oh, so sleep on a boat at night. So.
Sleep on the boat. Yeah, I don't have to worry about the bears. Yeah, I suppose you could do that and fly in Alaska, just like bring an anchor and go sleep on your raft out in the lake they dropped you off on.
Could. I guess you could, yeah. I mean, those bears do swim, so.
Yeah, that probably, not quite as much.
They do, but not.
And then if they pop, man, oh, yeah, they would for sure pop your raft. The first thing they would do, and then, now you're sinking. You could latch onto the bear to get home.
Oh, wow. That sounds fun.
You have a different definition of fun, I think. I don't know if I'm ready to bareback bronc ride a grizzly bear across a lake.
Yeah, I'm going to pass on that one.
So, awesome. Well, I appreciate you coming on the podcast today, Tyler. I know we're kind of eating up on an hour already, and but man, a lot of cool adventures you've been on. I'm excited to see what the next ones come on with, and we'll have to get you back on when you get your 10th one. You'll have to have a
man.
We'll sounds figure great. Something out, something special. We'll have to find a way to get them all in like the same shot.
it's gonna be a few years still with the ones I got left, so it's getting spendy.
I don't think they're handing out bison tags left and right either.
Nope.
You're doing the Henry Mountains Utah application for one or anything local, or
I apply for everything that I can, you know, South Dakota, all the applications. I thought that was
resident only. No,
they do. I believe they do have a non-resident.
Okay.
Was it Custer State Park, okay. I believe. So
I know Wyoming's got one, but the non-resident prices on that, it's probably almost cheaper to fly to the Yukon and shoot a muskox.
It used to be a lot easier to draw them too. So it's a lot changed.
I think it's like $6,000 just for the tag in Wyoming a non-resident. Yeah. Yeah. It was like 80-1, I think, resident to non-resident pricing. It was pretty wild.
Well, Wyoming's just gone off the rockers in general. So, I mean, look what they did for elk and antelope, you know. A special antelope tag is like, $2,000 almost? So it's like, $1,700 bucks?
I've never done the special tags. Just not worth it to me.
I don't know. It intrigues me because I think they're going to get a whole lot easier to draw at that price tag.
I don't know if easier they, for sure, but it seems like there's still people out there with money to blow. And I don't know. I'll just hunt somewhere else for a year.
That's fair.
You know, like we do all the states. So I've got like 97 points, I think, across the West. You've probably got a whole week full too. Yeah. Well, Utah, some of these states like Utah, like you buy your hunting license and then it's $10 a point. So you might as well buy all of the points, right? So you're getting eight a year. A few years, that adds up pretty fast, and you know there's a few states like that. So, but
I'm sitting on like 19 points for sheep and moose in Colorado. So it's like
Jesus, did you start applying when you were in the baby rocker or what?
I'm a little older than I look, but I've been applying since high school. So oh, wow. I convinced my parents to, I'm like, hey, I want to do this. Can we apply? Sure.
Yeah. So I want my birthday present to be a Colorado Moose Point.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's 10 bucks as a resident. So
that would be a cool hunt.
Yeah.
That'd be a state that would be fun. I've seen some big bulls in the Rocky Mountains.
Oh, a little something to think about if you want to shoot them. I don't dare say this, but if you look at the odds on a cow moose, they're pretty reasonable in Colorado.
Oh, really?
You know, you said well,
I don't
your
even have a point. Now the point, they got so expensive with the points that are. It's like I don't even start it now, you know?
Also, here's the thing. So you don't have points. What you could do, you could probably draw a cow moose tag with 3 or 4 points.
Really? Interesting.
Yep.
You have to keep that in mind.
It's expensive. It's still about $3,000 to go for a cow moose. But hey, if you want to shoot a moose, it can be done.
Yeah.
And I guarantee, I hate to say guarantee, but I bet you could.
If you work hard enough, a lot of times. Yeah. If you work hard enough, there's usually a good opportunity. I would probably, for that price, I'd probably just go a little bit more and do like a Canada hunt.
That's,
and the farther east you go in Canada, the more lower the prices go. It's basically like a zero per territory.
That's a good point.
If you're going British Columbia, it's pretty expensive. If you go like Eastern Ontario, it gets pretty reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when you add that Alaska Yukon in front of moose.
Yeah, that's another zero.
That's, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that would be awesome. I would love that. My bank account would not.
Nope. So, nope.
Maybe one day. We'll see how many people like and follow the podcast. Maybe eventually we can do a podcast hunt there. We'll bring on a listener like Randy Newberg does with his elk hunt.
That's like, awesome.
Enter to win a Yukon moose hunt. That would be pretty cool. That'd be crazy. Imagine winning.
Got a dream, right? Got a dream.
Yeah. Got a dream. Awesome. Well, I appreciate you being here, Tyler. Thank you for sharing all of your recent hunts and some of the crazy adventures you've been on. And thank you for listening.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.